This is Ann Smith, and I am doing the second session of the interview with Bob Cachet, and we are sitting at the Matheson Museum, and we have agreed that it would be helpful to go back over some of the details of what has been discussed and see if we can't fill in some of the things that Bob remembers. Today's date is April 20th, 2009, and I guess we were going to start, Bob, with the preparation that you remember on board ship before the landing. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Ann.
Okay, and what do you recall of that? What you were told and what took place?
It was very important that each of us were fully aware of the situation ashore, of the enemy defenses as far as intelligence had related to our officers, and also that we were as prepared as possible, emotionally as well as physically, for this endeavor. Life aboard ship, it is a unique experience. It entails endless chow lines, waiting and waiting.
Chow lines as in eating, huh?
Yeah, chow. Chow. C-H-O-W. Chow. We call it that.
Sure.
Excuse me if I go into some terminology.
Well, I'm doing this partly for the transcriptionist.
Lines were long, it was monotonous, and it was pretty crowded. On a troop ship, we had thousands of men living in very, very cramped quarters. There were just barely a few inches between you and the guy above you in your rack that you were assigned, which was simply a bunch of pipes with canvas spread between them, between the pipes. That was your home. And you put your packs on the end of the bunk. And there was an awful odor to this these compartments because of the closeness of men and the lack of freshwater showers. You simply had no fresh water available for showers, due to the large number of men aboard. So we had a thing called saltwater showers, but that was like taking a bath in Cairo syrup. It was just awful sticky, and the men did not take the saltwater shower. So we smelled, and we were confined to quarters for security reasons, because submarines, particularly at night, there was no light emission allowed. All portholes were sealed. Passageways had what they call blackout curtains. And so we were pretty well confined to a very small area. Rules were you could not go up on deck to get fresh air during the night or sleep up there where it wasn't so crowded. But a few of us, liberal-minded, went ahead and broke the rules and did go up on deck, and fortunately we're not caught, but we slept under a Higgins boat and had a good night's sleep. The reason that they said we could not go up there was the fact that previously some men had washed overboard. And once you're under convoy in combat zone, they cannot stop to pick you up. Radio silence and certainly breaking the chain of ships in the convoy was not allowed.
Uh-huh.
So those that fell over, and it did happen, not on our ship, but we heard on others, those that did fall overboard were simply left adrift. And that's what they wanted to avoid by saying we could not go up on deck.
Uh-huh.
Some of us did anyway. So we were moving towards the combat zone of our target island was Iwo Jima. And we stopped off at an island called Saipan, actually. And we taught then Saipan. But Saipan was a major stop where we refueled. We got the latest intelligence reports.
Mm-hmm.
And they allowed some of us to jump off the ship in the shark-infested waters. But we were glad to do it. That was just to refresh ourselves in the seawater.
Uh-huh.
It's still sticky. But we did this, and then, of course, we weighed anchor and headed towards Iwo Jima, our target. And this was February, I believe, the 17th or 18th. On D-Day, February the 19th, we received a word that bombardment had taken place for 72 days with bombing, with shelling, with striking with machine guns, and the island had been pretty well worked over. So some people thought, well, this might be a picnic, you know, 2 or 3 days and we'll head back to the next target island. Well, it didn't happen that way. And hello.
Hello.
We paused briefly for some outside noise, but Bob, why don't you continue with what you were saying about the ship? What was the name of the ship you were on? Do you remember?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I wish I could.
Well, I was going to ask you also, as long as I've already interrupted you, about the troop carriers being so close quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Were any of the people bothered by the claustrophobia and being so close to one another? I mean, it doesn't sound like you had very much space around.
To best of my knowledge, I saw no effects of claustrophobia. The inconvenience of having to be so confined was a major thing. But I didn't see any claustrophobic effect.
Yeah.
We did have some entertainment, if you will, when some guys volunteered for boxing matches.
Uh-huh.
And that was great. It was a diversion.
Sure.
And we also had a few card games going on.
Uh-huh.
And some people broke out dice. I think that was against the rules, but they
sure.
did it anyway.
Yeah.
They had so many guys waiting to get food that it was an almost continuous experience.
Yeah.
Getting in the chow line.
Yeah.
And of course, I can honestly say that the food was not exactly gourmet either. It was a little institutional. But we survived, and I was talking about D-Day preparation.
Yes.
That morning, I forget what time it was. It was very early in the morning. D-Day was 0900. And we were told that we were going to be given 6 sulfanilamide tablets. And we were to drink a canteen of water with them. The idea being that sulfur, which was new to the world,
that's right,
would help with infection if we got hit. And so we were ordered, incidentally, to do that. We had no choice. So we did take the sulfur pills. We were then treated, and I mean treated, to an open galley where the galley served everything they had. We could have ham, eggs, bacon, pancakes, whatever they had in there on D-Day morning, they gave us. And it was wonderful to have such a decent breakfast for a change. However, it was rather sad in one respect, because that was the last meal many Marines ever ate. And that occurred, of course, with the casualties that took place on the island. However, we, as I say, we were well fed, we took our stuff up, we waited and waited and waited for word to debark. Finally, word came to go over the side, and then an experience occurred which was somewhat hazardous, because as you climb down a cargo net, you have on your back a rifle, you have a field pack, you're encumbered with ammunition, with grenades, and a first aid pack, and so forth. And the ship is bouncing up and down with the waves, and 40 feet below you is a small Higgins boat waiting to receive you if you make it. And it too was bouncing up and down with the waves and banging against the ship. So it was quite an experience, and fortunately most guys that I know of made it. I don't know how. Because as you came down, if your hands were on the rung of the rope and the guy above you, and you were like a herd of monkeys, you know, he sometimes would step on your hands.
Yes, yes.
Coming down. But that was part of it. And we did make it. Fortunately, the sea was fairly calm that morning. We were waiting, of course, for word from the officer in charge to set up on the LD, which was the line of departure. On we circled and circled. Finally, we got the word to enter what we call the line of departure. And then once we were in line, we headed towards the beach. However, then the sea took its toll. Because the wonderful breakfast we had suddenly became food for fish, because seasickness embraced many of the guys on this bouncing Higgins boat.
I wondered about that.
And not everyone was on the edge of the Higgins boat, so they used their helmet to receive their breakfast.
Oh dear.
It was not a bunch of happy campers. Added to that was the fact that we were under fire from enemy artillery and mortars, mostly artillery. And fortunately, though, the sea remained fairly calm. There were waves enough to make you seasick. I was lucky. I was a Florida boy that had been around the water and worked on fishing boats, and I didn't get seasick. I was very fortunate. But a lot of the guys did. And I have to say again, it wasn't a rough sea, but it was enough of a swell that caused them to upchuck, if you will.
Oh dear. So that meal became a liability.
So it was fun and games. And then we got the word to lock and load and hunker down. We were approaching the island, and what time it was, but we were not the first wave. If I remember right, I'm not sure, I think we were the sixth wave. And at that time, there were casualties. And as our Higgins boat grounded against the sands of Iwo Jima, there were dead bodies rolling, dead Marines rolling in the wave, and I clearly remember that. It was such a welcome, if you will, or an unwelcome entrance to the island.
Oh, yes.
That was wartime. The ramp went down until we moved out into the soft volcanic ash, and we sunk down pretty well above our boondockers.
Yes.
And tried to find some place where we could get down in a hole, because there were a lot of shell holes. We did move under fire. Again, there were casualties. The corpsmen, bless their hearts, they were there doing what they could to patch up the holes and guys and to administer morphine and get them ready for evacuation out to the hospital ships, which were waiting out in the ocean. But we had orders to get off the beach. That was, they were adamant, get off the beach. And unfortunately, not doing unfortunately, not every guy made it off the beach, but I was one of the fortunate ones that didn't. No, we moved back there.
Yeah. Okay, so so trying to find a place for cover, to say nothing of get off the beach, is your challenge.
Yes, it was. And we slogged, and I do mean slogged, through that volcanic ash, black volcanic ash, as we moved forward, going toward the other end of the island, which was roughly 700 yards away, because we were at the narrow neck on Red Beach, just below Mount Suribachi. And that in itself was a problem, because they were shooting down on us from the top of the 540-foot Mount Suribachi. So we did move forward as best we could, I should say slogged through that volcanic ash, and frankly, we didn't get very far. We stopped at times because of the intensity of the fire. And I clearly remember, I forget what time it was, I think it was in, I don't know, noon or right afternoon. And we happened to be in a shell hole. On a mortar or artillery, I think it was a mortar, went off right next to us and buried us up to our armpits. And what saved us was that the volcanic ash was so soft that the shell did not explode on the surface. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here talking to you.
Really?
It buried itself in that loose volcanic ash, and then it exploded and caused the ash cores to come out all over us. And the guy in the next foxhole, I remember his name, Iggy, he was carried off as a shell shock victim. It just tore him apart in those things. But I don't believe he was wounded, I can't say for sure. My foxhole buddy and I, this guy was Bill, we were buried, but not really harmed, except we were, I believe, cussing because we had to clean our weapons. We couldn't fire our weapons. They were covered with sand.
So you could kind of dig yourselves out.
Oh, yes, yes.
But in some ways, the shell was smothered by the ash?
Yes, the depth of the explosion saved it. The ash was so soft, it didn't cause the shell or the mortar artillery, I don't know, to explode on contact.
But it blew the ash all over everywhere.
Yeah, until it got down in further, and then it exploded. It was a percussion shell that obviously meant that it had to impact some fairly solid surface before it exploded. That saved us. So we were pretty upset about that.
Yeah.
Having to dig ourselves out, which we did. And we did eventually get our weapons where we could use them, but they were a mess.
Yeah.
And so were we. But we continued across the island and moved when we could, in spite of casualties, in spite of the Japanese enemy on top of Mount Suribachi firing down on us, which of course increased the amount of fire that was coming onto us.